Welcome to The Friday Habit with Mark Labriola and Benjamin Manley. The Friday Habit is for small business owners, freelancers, and creatives who are ready to take their business to the next level. Join us as we discover how to apply the strategies we learn to grow our businesses, make more money, and live every day like it's Friday. And welcome to The Friday Habit. Once again, habiting on the Friday, but I guess it just depends on when you're listening to this. You may be listening to this on a Monday, so you may not be as in those Friday energies, but you know what I say, right? Live every day like it's Friday. So anyways, hey, Ben, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Friday means, you know, for me, that means pizza, popcorn, and movie night with the kids. What's Friday for you?
Same, dude. Family movie night, actually.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way to do it.
But sometimes nice. We do a charcuterie, you know?
Okay. Wow. Fancier than me. We all know that. You're fancier.
Not always pizza, so. Well, hey, man. I'm excited for our guest today. We have Megan Gluth-Bohan on, and she is an award-winning entrepreneur, CEO, and owner of Tri International Inc., and owner of Chem Blend of America. As the owner and CEO of a multinational corporation, Megan Gluth-Bohan is a picture of success. Megan is living proof that now is always the best time to take the first step forward. Megan, welcome to the Friday Habit.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. It's so good to be here.
Yeah. So, I would love to hear a little bit about your story and just kind of sounds like a big deal. You are a multinational corporation CEO. I mean, that's...
It sounds pretty cool, doesn't it? I will say, though, cool I am, I'm not so cool that my kids will eat a charcuterie board on a Friday night.
they're not down with the fig jam?
Listen, we're really into the dino nuggets in our house. They are they are organic, though. So I feel
get down.
A little...
I can
fancy.
Get down on the dino nuggets. You know, we get those from Costco.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know? Kirkland brand. Yeah, yes.
That's right. Yeah. It's very, very fancy.
That's right. No, thanks for the ask. So I run and own, I guess it was two companies. It's now one. I made an acquisition of Chem Blend after owning TRI, and have merged them together into one company. Our business, in its simplest form, it's actually kind of complicated, but it's also really simple. All companies in the United States that make something buy raw materials to make the thing that they make. And so our customers are companies that make things. We sell companies that make soft drinks. We sell companies that make infant formula. We also sell companies products that make paint and downhole oil fluid. And so it's really neat because I'm a person who likes to learn how things are made and how people create. And so a huge part of our business is the sourcing and supply of those raw materials. The other part of our business is often making those things for these companies. So a lot of these companies that put their brand or their label on something are having them contract manufactured, and we're also doing that. So the cool part of my work is that we are engaging with companies that are all over the world, and I get to learn a lot about that. I get to learn a lot about how people create and people make, but I get to see a lot of people who do like really an honest day's work, and in so doing have created some of the brands that you and I engage with every single day. So that's sort of the 30,000 foot view on what my business does. Mm.
So when you were a little girl, were you just dreaming about working for a multinational company making downhole oil? What did you say?
No. You don't even have to finish.
That was my follow-up question. What is downhole oil? I need to learn more.
Downhole oil drilling fluids. Yeah. It's another podcast. Also really cool, actually. Really cool. Some of the coolest science you'll learn on the planet. But I grew up as a little girl in small town Iowa. And my story includes starting from a place of, you know, I grew up with a single mom, and we didn't have a lot of money. And my story has lots of the elements of a start of poverty. And in some cases, things that sort of are the not so glamorous sides of that kind of a life. And that's important, I think, because I don't shy away from that, because I think it's really, really important for everybody who hears from me to know that, like, no matter where you are and how you start, like, you literally can go anywhere. And it's okay if your anywhere isn't someplace that you imagine it being at any given moment. Like, my life is a series of just doing the next thing that seemed like the right thing to do. But I grew up in that environment. I worked really hard. And the only thing that I knew that I wanted was not to struggle. I just didn't want to struggle. And that's kind of the only thing I knew that I wanted. And for a long time, that was my sole motivation. And anybody who is listening, who has been there, knows that that can't be your motivation forever. Like, the gas in that tank runs out. But I went to college. I got kicked out of college because I prioritized other things over academics.
I mean, I can't imagine what that would be, but... Yeah.
They have brand names. And again, that's part of the story too, right? Like, colossal mistakes. I don't have really anyone to blame for that but myself. And I guess that's what makes it cool, right? Because then I can fix that. I can be the remedy for that. And after finally getting a bachelor's degree, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was getting a bachelor's degree in history, which is like, you either got to be cool with teaching high school history or you're going to take the LSAT. And I took the LSAT, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
And I ended up getting into law school. And, not even entirely sure that I wanted to be a lawyer or what that would look like. But again, it's just sort of this next indicated thing.
And now, did you feel like it was one of those things where, you know, opportunities presented themselves and then you had a decision to say yes or no to that opportunity? Because I feel a lot of times we operate in a place of fear where we're unsure of, if we should do something or if we shouldn't do something. And I feel like I've kind of lived my life with the motto of just say yes, you know, like no matter what it is, you know, even if you feel a little inconfident, like, okay, I don't know if I can do this or I'm not sure I'm capable. It's like, all right, just say yes and then figure it out, because I feel like there's always reward. And I've experienced that, you know, over the past 15 years of my life, you know, owning a business and doing things. I just say yes and I figure things out. And then it all has a way of working itself out.
100%. And I think that if you are intuitive at all, and I am, I lead from a place of strong intuition, both in my personal life and in my business life. I think we all, no matter what you do in this world, come to moments where you have to just kind of gut check it. And I tend to lean in the direction of whatever my gut says. Now, sometimes that isn't just saying yes. Yeah. And I've said no to things that people on the outside might look and go, are you crazy? That's a yes. I wasn't feeling it.
How did you say no?
Right. Yeah. And I'm glad, usually in hindsight, that I said no. But in that case, I didn't know what else to do with myself. I just knew I didn't want to be a teacher. And somebody in a class I was in was like, well, I'm going to take the law school exam and see if I can get in. And I was like, okay, cool. I guess I'll do that. Like, it wasn't, I didn't set a goal. I wasn't that kind of a driven individual. I was somebody who was abusing alcohol. I was kind of just, you know, doing my thing. Like, I knew I wanted to do better, but like, I wasn't a person who was like making a vision board and setting goals.
Yeah. Like Bob Ross says, happy little accident.
That's right. That's right. Or happy big accident.
You're just one big happy accident.
That's right. That's right. And I'm good with that. Yeah. So I got into law school, and actually, like, a really pivotal part of my story is that a couple weeks before it started, I get my financial aid package, and nobody is paying for this. And I've been always working to get through school. But when you started law school at that time, the American Bar Association had a rule that you couldn't work a certain number of hours while you were in your first year of law school. So I needed money.
Like, how am I going to pay for this?
Yeah.
I
needed to take out some private loans to kind of cover what the government loans weren't going to cover. And I didn't have I was not credit worthy individual. I couldn't have done that. And my family, like, there's no one in my family who could do that. So a friend of mine's dad co-signed on my law school loans.
Wow.
And just to give you an idea, that was about it was over $100,000 of law school loans that he co-signed on.
And, that's crazy.
He changed my life. Like, he changed my life with that one act.
Why would someone do that?
He grew up in sort of similar circumstances. And he just told me, he said, I'm going to do this for you. And I want you, when you're in the opportunity to do it yourself, I want you to do it for someone else. And I know why he said that to me now for two reasons. Like, I know why he was doing it, why he felt compelled to do it. And I know why he knew that it would be awesome for me to do it. And I understand that now. I couldn't have understood that then because I didn't have the life experience. But it is, there comes a point where in your world, when you gain influence or power or money or whatever it is that you get, like to use that to the benefit of someone else is absolutely incredible. And he knew that and he did that for me.
Now, do you feel like that added more pressure for you to do well in law school?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to let him down.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, I think that seems like, you know, the universe was trying to help you along in some ways for sure.
And I didn't want to let him down. And I wanted to go about the work honestly, you know, and I knew that the end of law school needed to end with me getting a job, you know, like and that I would be paying on these loans.
Right. Yeah.
Come hell or high water, I am not letting this guy make a loan payment for me. You know?
Yeah. So then how was law school? The other question I had for you real quick was, were you like the first person in your family to go to college and like get a degree, or were you, you know?
Not exactly. My grandfather had gotten, one of my grandfathers had gotten a college degree on the GI Bill. And so when he had an opportunity to do that, he actually became a teacher. But a lot of my family it serves in other ways, you know, maybe other kinds of blue collar work. My father was a blue collar worker his entire life. And I say that because that was something I really looked up to and admired about him. He went to work and worked hard every single day.
You said you grew up with your mom, or your parents were like separated?
Yeah, my parents divorced when I was young. So they lived about 70 miles apart from one another. I tell people I grew up in Iowa and Minnesota because I grew up, he was in Minnesota, she was in Iowa, but only about 70 miles from each other.
Okay. And then you just split your time between the two of them? And
no, I definitely was primarily living with my mom. And they each remarried and had what we call the second batch of kids, you know? Yeah. So it kind of gave me a really cool thing. I have this like really large tribe.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
And it's sort of hard to explain to people without like markers and pencils and stuff. But but they each sort of throughout their life evolved, right? And and became different people later in life than they were when I knew them in younger life, right? Like it's very different to watch the evolution of people. When you're young, you don't see your parents as people, and you don't recognize that they're not fixed, and that they too are moving beings in the world. When I was a kid, I just assumed this is, you know, this monolithic presence. But yeah, they both throughout their lives evolved to become different people for sure.
Now, you got kicked out of college, and then you went to law school. Was learning easy for you, or did you have an innate ability to like pick up on things and and like learn?
Yeah, learning is really, really easy for me. What wasn't easy for me was like managing life and emotion. And so I'm super honest about that too. Like, you can have a lot of talent, but if you can't get your emotional house in order, which I could not, then I couldn't go anywhere with that. And so my way of dealing with everything really was alcohol. Like, I loved it. I loved everything about leaning into that. And I am now, you know, 13 years clean and sober for good reason. I'm not a person who used that in the appropriate way. And one of the first casualties of my life that alcohol took was my ability to stay in college. And to come back from that is hard, because it's hard to get kicked out of school. It's not saying I dropped out, now I'm ready to come back. You have to go tell the next institution I've changed. Yeah.
You know, it's a little embarrassing. Yeah. Humbling for sure.
Super.
Yeah.
But again, possible. You can do that. And I did. I got kicked out of school, so I got a job for a while. I lived with my grandparents and went to work. And then as soon as I had, you know, some working and things like that, I'm like, okay, I want to go back to school. I want to try this. So then I had to go to a community college. Mm. And I had to put together a transcript from a community college showing that I was a person who knew how to go to school and who could do mm-hmm. it. And then I applied to a university again and was accepted. But that was a long process.
Yeah.
So I joke with people and say, in the time it took me to get my BA, I should have been a doctor. And it's kind of true.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you graduated law school. And did you still not really know what you wanted to do at that point? Or was there like particular law that you wanted to study or, you know, direction that you wanted to go?
I loved the study of law because I think at my core, I'm a nerd. And I knew, I don't think I know. I just know this about myself. I'm a nerd. And I like
you
having...
You seem kind of nerdy.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to fly that flag.
You're welcome. You're welcome here. Yeah.
Ben can relate.
It's okay, Ben.
I can relate, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And was alcohol still part of your
100%.
Life at that point? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Best part of every day, right? The best part of waking up, you know? And I'm super honest about that, too, because I just I don't mm-hmm. think it pays in life to go through this stuff and then lie about it or to sugarcoat
it. Yeah, try to protect your ego, you know, because that really is not going to help anybody at the end of the day, you know?
No, not at all.
Mm. Yeah.
And my goal in life is to, if I can help one person, and encourage one person, I'm good. I'm solid, you know, and I feel that. I really do. But it was at that time and in that sort of transition point in my life that I decided to move to the West Coast. And the reason for that is that I love being outside. And in that respect, nature healed me. I would come out to the Pacific Northwest in the month of January or February and be hiking. And I was like, this is it. This is the life, you know, and I just fell in love with it. So I quit my job at a law firm in Minnesota one day, which, by the way, was really hard to do because the financial crisis had been raging and having a job was a big deal. I took out all of the money that was in my 401k or IRA or whatever it was. It was like probably, I don't know, $4,000 or something. You know what I mean? I don't even remember. And I was like, I'm moving to the West Coast. You know what I mean? And like, I did. I packed up my dog and I moved out west and I studied for the bar in the state of Oregon, where I was going to set up shop first. And that's what I did. It was just sort of this huge leap of faith to leave what I knew and come someplace where I knew only a few people. And make something of myself. And that was transformative for me.
Mm. And so do you feel like it was kind of like this new chapter of your life? Like you could kind of be whoever you wanted to be at that point?
Yeah, I do think that now. But at the time, I didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
I was running, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So where did the entrepreneurial, like, thing happened to you? You know, you're a lawyer, right?
Mm-hmm.
An attorney, you know, practicing law. Seems like a pretty good gig, you know, financially and whatnot. And, you know, stable. I think we always need lawyers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No matter how the economy's doing, somebody needs to get sued.
That's right. That's right. We're here for you.
That's right. So what was that turn or like, where did you find yourself, mm-hmm. you know, starting that journey?
Yeah. So I was the kind of lawyer that would advise businesses that in legal terms we call closely held corporations, which is basically companies that weren't publicly traded. I'm assuming most of your listeners know that, but that's in the law, mm-hmm. that's kind of a distinction, right? If you're somebody like post IPO, then I probably am not your lawyer anymore. Like I was, you know, sort of in this privately held. And so I got to deal with people who were starting their business at the very, very beginning, or people mm-hmm. who had been running a successful enterprise for 50 years and wanted to figure out how they were going to pass that on to their kids. So I was all the way, or sell it. You know what I mean? Whatever the options were, I was in these people with all sorts of things. Sometimes there would be shareholder dispute litigation that I would be doing mm-hmm. between the shareholders. You know, two brothers are arguing because they inherited dad's company, all sorts of stuff. But the thing that was common through all of it is that I was addicted to this energy of the creator, They're all creatives, every single one of them. I'm not saying like creative in the terms of like artists, but an entrepreneur, and you guys know this, is one of the most creative forces on the face of the earth. Just is. And we are always agitating and thinking about the next thing and eating dinner and thinking about, oh, what if I did this? And every single day I was meeting, you know, in 6 minute increments with with people who were doing this, and I loved it. And I had a mentor tell me once, I had worked for her at a law firm, and she said, Meg, whatever you do in your life, I hope that you move into some sort of entrepreneurship because you're good at it. You love it. Because what would happen is that I'd be sitting there with people and I'd be like, well, what if you do this? What if you do that? I'm your lawyer. I should just tell you how to cover your ass. You know what I mean? And then nothing else. But I couldn't. I wanted to create with them. And so
problem solving mentality.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it just was one of those things. I ended up meeting this guy named Tony in Seattle when I was moving to Seattle and going to interview at law firms here. And I wanted to know a little bit about the firm's culture. And a friend of mine from law school said, I know a guy in Seattle who might know a lot of those lawyers. His name's Tony. He owns this like chemical and raw materials business. You should meet him. I was like, cool. So I came and I met him, and we called him TR, and that's where the name TR International came from. He started this business in 1994 after he left West Point. And he and I sat and chatted, and we just connected. He offered me a job as the company's first general counsel, and I took it.
Oh, nice.
Oh.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's how I ended up here. And then I became his succession plan. Together.
Okay.
We co-created that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were like creating a succession plan, and you just wrote your own name in, and he was like, okay, yeah, that sounds good.
Sorta. I mean, here's the thing. He was at a point in his career where he was getting ready to be like, okay, maybe I don't want to grind it out this hard. Everybody who runs and owns their own business knows what I'm talking about. Like, you are firing on all cylinders, and it's something you can't understand unless you're doing it. And there comes a point where the burn rate for that has to slow down, and he was there. And I understood that. And so I really liked the business. So first I was the general counsel, then I became the president, and then I became the CEO. So now I'm the CEO, I'm running the company, I'm having an awesome time, and we have to figure out what's going to be next for him. And so that's how it sort of evolved from there. So it was actually really, really natural for that.
Yeah, that's awesome. What did that process look like? Oh, like, how gradual was that? You know, I know you mentioned the couple position changes, but what did that look like from a practical perspective as you switched over the years? What responsibilities shifted to you, and how did that process work?
Yeah, I think that what's cool about a business when you're working with somebody who is open to it. So one of his greatest gifts was that he always was smart enough to know that if there was somebody that was rising in his organization, his job was to get out of their way. And he did that for me. And so it started where I would be in rooms, very practically speaking. I'd be in rooms and we'd be talking about contracts that need to be written for deals to be put together. Well, then he and I might sit and talk about, is there a way for this deal to get put together better? And I had an affinity for it and I was good at it. And it started to just become where I was becoming more commercial without dropping I'm always going to be a lawyer. I'm licensed to practice law in 3 states. I'm never not going to be like that in my head, right?
Sure.
But what we were doing is we were watching both of us, talents that I had for this unfold. And so what he did, and again, just one of his greatest credits is he got out of the way. And he'd be like, okay, why don't you take over that? Why don't you do that? And I was like, yes, cool, let's do it. And so he saw it and he nurtured it and he just let me go because he understood that instead of micromanaging me, if he just let me go, he could stand and be a witness to what would come, you know?
Yeah.
And so when it came time for us to have the conversation about me, okay, like, cool, like if I can put together, if we can figure out some way for me to figure out this financing, can I buy this company from you? Can I start with half? Well, actually, we're going to do 55% because that, you know, we don't want to have 50-50, like whatever. Okay, I'm going to buy 55% of the company from you. We get that figured out. And then COVID hits. And for him, he was like, we had done this 55% and we thought, okay, we'll do this for as long as he wants to continue being here at 45%. And when he wants to fully retire, we'll figure the rest of it out. We were completely communicative and cool with that. Mm-hmm. COVID hits and he is, you guys, he'd already seen 62 crises. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and he was just like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then within a year, I bought the rest of it out. So I held 55% of it for a year, and then I had the whole thing.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Well, yeah, it sounds like it happened fast once it started happening naturally. Then I was like, okay, this just makes sense. And you just kept on that path. Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
Go ahead, Ben.
Oh, go ahead. You go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, did you have a pretty public like face within the company when that took place as far as, you know, was there any difficulty with employees like looking at you as the leader or, you know, having that confidence that you're going to be able to grow, you know, the business and keep everybody employed?
Definitely very public face. I'd sort of already been their boss for a while though. And okay. I think that's one of the things that, that I can strongly recommend if somebody is thinking about their business succession and they already have somebody they're grooming for that position or they have in mind, it's really good to have them in that leadership spot and sort of get out of the way and give them the opportunity to take the reins before you make the transition. Cause everybody, honestly, if you ask the people who worked here, I don't think it represented for them. The day that we signed the sale paperwork didn't really matter to them. Do you know what I mean? I think it was kind of a non-event.
Right, yeah. Right. Because everybody's kind of used to you running things already. Everything's just, oh, it's continuing. For them, it's continuing on as usual.
Yes.
And that's really smart, too, because if you have that ability to have somebody run it first and test drive everything, then you know you're selling your company to somebody that cares, that you trust, and it's not necessarily bad to be absorbed by another company, but I can see for the employees that your situation is more ideal for sure, to where it's like, okay, this is comfortable, it's somebody I know, the mission's not changing, things are continuing on. So that's really cool.
Why not just promote you to CEO and then just become like chairman of the board and just let you run things and him still own it? I mean, what was the conversation there?
He and I still have this conversation about the extra, he and I call it mind share. Uh-huh. When you own a business, and he was the sole shareholder of this company, and it remains that way today. I'm the sole shareholder. The mind share of owning an entity still has its own drain on you as a person. Now, some people are okay with that. Some people will say, I want somebody else to run it, and this is gonna be an annuity for me, or whatever it is, right? But he, you guys, he lives in an awesome house on the lake now and rows every day. And we just had lunch a couple weeks ago. He's like, Meg, I don't think about any of that shit anymore. You know? And yeah. You know what I mean? And he doesn't have to come sit in a meeting and make sure that financially it's okay. He doesn't have that stress. Like, he has the true peace that he's earned. And I think for him, the only way to achieve that was to not own it anymore. Mm-hmm. And then you can have that moment, that liquidation moment, and then you go invest your money or you do whatever. But like that for him was the best way to get that piece.
That makes sense. I mean, especially depending on your personality too. I think some people have a sense of really strong responsibility. So even when somebody else is running it, you know, at the end of the day, it's up to you if something goes wrong or whatever, it might be finding a replacement for that person. And so I could see people with that instinct, it would be harder to kind of let go.
For sure. And I think he and I are both that way. I mean, like I said, you got to remember, he's West Point trained, like duty, honor, country. Like, he's going to make sure that everything's okay. And I love that about him. I love that about him to this day. Yeah.
That's awesome. So does that bring us up to current day then? Is this, what's happened since then, since you took over and, you know, bought the company and everything? How's that been going?
Well, listen, it's kind of strange to be a brand new company owner and then have a global pandemic hit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you came in at a rough moment, right?
Yeah, so it was a few sleepless nights, you know, I maybe...
Yeah, I believe that.
Worked my way through some Xanax. No, it's a... No, it's been an education for me in this... You can advise a business. You can read all the books. You could get 52 MBAs. I'm going to tell you, like, and I say this to all my friends who are still business lawyers, until you're sitting in the seat, you don't know what the seat feels like. And this is one of those seats. So I'm constantly a learner every day. But since I bought the business, I've doubled the size of the business. And I'm proud of that. And I haven't done that alone. I have an incredible team of people around me, from my CFO all the way down to the people driving a forklift at our plant in Chicago. I value them all the same way, and I have such admiration and respect for them. We are all swimming in the same direction, and we're doing the thing. So a lot has changed, and I haven't done that alone.
When I was reading some stuff on your bio, I saw this term empathetic leadership.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you, and like, how do you employ that in your own company?
I tell everybody in my company, we're not a family, we're a community. Okay. And I say that because I think a lot of times in business leadership books, it's like you want to act like you're a family or your friends or we're all in it together. We're not. This is a for-profit corporation, and my job is to make profit. And that's what this enterprise will do. And we are a community of people who are all committed to that objective. And if we're not, then we're not part of the same community. Right? Maybe you don't work here anymore or whatever. Like that's the deal. And so I'm super clear about that. Within that, we're human beings. And so I think empathetic leadership means that you can hold the objective of being a capitalist, which I am. I'm not running a nonprofit. I donate to them, but this isn't my deal. I want to make money, and I need to, because I got these families of people who work for me that want me to do it too, right? And we all got to do it together. And so you can hold the two things of being a capitalist who wants to make money and also realizing that these people in your community are humans, and the good of the least healthy person in the community affects the whole community. And so I'm not sympathetic. I don't run a pity train. But I have a lot of empathy for what affects people as humans. And then we deal with that. And I think it's so important to do that and to distinguish that as leaders, because I think that right now we're caught in a little bit of a tension where if you're going to recognize the humanity of an employee, that means that you have to give them everything they want all the time. No. I think we can empathize with where they're at. We can try and make this community help cover them when needed and create some things around accessibility or whatever. But at the end of the day, the goal of the community is profit. And that's what we're doing. And we can be really clear about both things.
I like that. That's really, you don't hear it explained like that, you know? And I think too, it's like, you know, a community, typically is working towards, you know, a goal. And a family, sometimes you put up with stuff, you know, like an uncle who gets trash and tells an inappropriate story. It's like, well, he's family, you know, and you just deal with it. When it's like a community, you kind of hold each other to a higher standard, you know, and I like that thought. So, well, you know, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for hanging out with us.
Yeah, and thank you.
Just sharing some of your wisdom and you know, just... enriching our lives. So, Ben, what are your key takeaways from today's episode?
Well, there are a lot of them, so I'll just take a few of them here. But one thing you said that stuck with me is you can be very talented, but if you don't have your emotions in order, it's hard to go places. You also said, don't sugarcoat your past. Be honest about it. If you can help just one person, it's worth it. Entrepreneurship is one of the most creative forces on the face of the earth. He said, if you do have alcohol or drug addiction, you're not inherently broken and you're not alone. And finally, no matter where you are and how you start, you can go anywhere.
Ah, there you go. Hey, if you could leave our audience with one action item for next week to say, hey, this is how you can better yourself or better your business or start on a path to success, what would that advice be?
I'd tell everybody to spend 10 minutes just getting super honest about exactly where they're at. Know your starting point. Just know exactly where you're standing today. It'll serve you well.
Oh, that's great. Where can people connect with you if they want to follow you online or reach out? Or are you writing any books? What do you got going on?
Yeah, no, I have a personal website that I think they probably could find through you guys, but MeganGluthBohan.com. Come check me out there. I really do try to connect with people, and so there's a good chance you might actually hear from me, and I'd love to do that.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for listening to today's episode. If you go to thefridayhabit.com, you can find show notes for this episode. There you can also find links to our websites and ways to get in touch. And at the bottom of the page, you can download our guide to the Friday Habit System that will show you how to set aside one full day each week dedicated to working on your business instead of in your business.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app. And if you have any questions for us or topics you'd like us to cover or guests you'd like us to interview, send us an email at hello@thefridayhabit.com.
That's right. Thanks for listening. And remember, live every day like it's Friday.